Hey there, tax fans. Welcome to State Tax Talks with me, your host, Joe Tantillo. I'm a tax attorney at the Hodge and Russ Law Firm looking to explore the nuances of state and local tax law. Here on the show, our goal is to keep tax informative, simple, and fun. So if you're ready to talk tax, turn up the volume and dive into this episode of State Tax Talks. Welcome back, tax fans. I'm here with Chris Doyle and Drew Wright. We're going to continue our discussion of non-resident allocation, starting with multi-year allocation right now. So let's start with the premise of, you know, multi-year allocation. What is that? Is it as simple as it sounds?
I think it sounds a lot more simple than it works in reality. But the concept is this. If you've got income that you've earned over a series of years, it would be inappropriate to allocate it based on 1 year's factors. So if you have stock option income or a deferred bonus or an earnout or in 2017, a bunch of hedge fund managers had a bunch of deferred compensation that they took into account. The state and other taxing jurisdictions takes the position that you should use the period of time over which the income was earned and the apportionment factors or the allocating of the items to apply to that income. You shouldn't just use the year of receipt because all of that income comes into your tax account in the year you receive it. It doesn't, you know, you don't take it into account ratably over every year. If it's paid to you in 2022, that's when you take it into account. But if you earned it over a 7 year period, you know, 2015 through 2022, that's actually 8 years, then you should use that period of time and those factors that existed during that period of time to allocate the income.
And this is an interesting one because it gets into a situation where different types of income have different rules. And we see all the time that, you know, even accountants get this wrong and they sometimes just allocate everything based on the year of receipt. And, you know, you have to dive into the nitty gritty details on multi-year allocation. And you have to understand, for starters, you know, well, what type of income are we talking about? Even, you know, different kinds of stock compensation has different rules.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, because I live in my residency and personal income tax bubble, I deal a lot with wage income. And it's the very first question I ask, right? When I see a high wage earner, the very first question I ask is, what are the components of your wage? Because I know just by looking at the number that it's not going to be 100% salary. For folks who get 100% salary, that's their wage. Allocating is easy, right? It's work days during the year you receive the salary. If I have any of these other things we're talking about built into my wage, bonuses, deferred comp, stock awards, the most important part of this is what is the period of time that I'm going to examine my work days to allocate that wage? And I can't tell you the number of times that is, you know, the accountants or return preparers get that wrong or don't even ask the question, right? And I certainly one of the big mistakes that I see for folks who are not, you know, sort of experienced in these allocation rules is they just take whatever numbers on the W-2, right? The employer spits out a W-2. There's a wage amount in the New York box. And sometimes accountants will just plop that number onto the tax return. And the first thing I do is say, no, we got to look at the wage. We got to understand the components. And then we got to source it, right? And if the amount on the W-2 is right, great. But if it's not, we got to use the right number based on the underlying facts and circumstances.
I think deferred bonuses is the one that we see like most commonly just ends up wrong. You know, a bonus paid in 2021 for services performed in 2020, and yet it's allocated based on 2021 workdays. And you'd think that one would be easier, right?
Yeah. I mean, look, sometimes it doesn't have a big impact, right? You know, if someone's workdays in the New York percentages are consistent from year to year, sometimes that mistake doesn't have a big tax impact. But for a lot of folks, it's not, right? Their New York workdays may be wildly different in 1 year in the next. And lots of people get a bonus, right? And so for bonuses, I'm generally asking people up front just to get at the issue. When is it paid, right? Mm-hmm. When did you get your bonus? Did you get it in January, February, March? Did you get it in December? And if you get it in the early part of the year, to your point, Joe, most likely it's a bonus that relates to prior year service. And geez, we need to allocate that based on where you worked in the prior year, not during the year it's paid.
And I think what makes it so relevant in our line of work is people who are changing residency from one year to the next. And oftentimes, if it's done without proper planning, this idea that, hey, you know, in 2021, I was a non-resident. Look at all this income I had. And then, you know, we break down the income and we look at the returns and all of a sudden it's like, yeah, well, you had a $5 million bonus that was paid to you in March that was really for services that you performed in the prior year when you were a resident.
Yeah. So it's why I'm often the bearer of bad news when when folks make that call, right? Because people think, geez, I'm going to move to Florida. There's no tax. I'm going to get this big component of income, whatever it is, and I'm going to save a bunch of tax. And if we're talking about wage income and deferred bonuses, look, if I earned it last year and I worked in New York, New York's likely to get a really significant part of that bonus, even if you move to Florida.
I think it's where this issue of non-resident allocation becomes so significant to the process of tax planning and the process of residency planning is keeping in mind that you really need to sometimes look ahead, you know, 2-3 years, if you're thinking you may have a large income event coming up, or you're you know, you are granted stock options in 1 year and you may not want to pay tax on the income that you're going to earn from those. It's not as simple as, well, I'll just move the year before it vests or the year before I sell. You got to take a long look down the road. And that, I think, can be one of those things that just people miss.
Yeah.
Yeah, and one thing that's out there that's available is a Section 83B election. That's a federal tax election that you can make when you get an equity award like that, or a phantom equity award. And what it essentially does, it requires you to take into your income as compensation the value at that time of the award. And of course, everybody hopes the value will go up. And the problem with that is you don't have cash to pay the tax on the value of that award if you make the 83B election, but if you've got cash on hand to make that tax payment, it's usually a good idea because it takes away the detriment to moving outside of the state, becoming a non-resident, and then cashing in that equity award and having to pay tax on it later on to New York, where maybe it's appreciated, you know, 12-fold.
Right.
Yeah, and putting aside the state sourcing components of that, right? There can be big federal tax benefits too because the rate difference is between wage income and capital gain.
Yep, absolutely. Good point. It's not all bad news. Sometimes Drew will get a call from a non-resident who's got a qualified pension.
Yeah, yeah. I like those calls, right? Where someone calls and they say, hey, I worked in New York a long, long time and now I lived in Florida and I'm getting payouts from some kind of retirement plan. And yeah, depending on what kind of plan it is, there's a federal law, right, that says only the state of residence can tax certain categories of retirement income. And then there can be really big benefits, right? If it happens to be one of those kinds of retirement income, and pensions are a good example, now I don't pay any tax to New York, even if I worked 100% of my days during my period of employment in New York.
So if you're listening, call your grandma and tell her pension is okay.
Grandma's got to actually move first, though.
Yes, tell grandma to move first, and then her pension is okay.
Grandma can't just be a snowbird.
No, don't be a snowbird. You'll get caught. You'll get caught by the tax boogeyman. All right, we could have a whole probably 10-hour series of episodes on the multi-year allocation issues and diving into the hard details of different types of income and comp, et cetera. But we're not going to do that on this episode. We'll save that for the future. So stay tuned and subscribe and like this YouTube video and share, et cetera, and all the things that you're supposed to do. But we're going to pivot into allocating income from flow-through entities, because this is another topic that we see coming up time and time again that is relevant to a lot of taxpayers who don't necessarily get a salary, or maybe you get a salary and you have some flow-through income. So let's talk to Professor Chris about how to allocate and or apportion income from partnerships and proprietorships.
So that's business income. And unfortunately, actually fortunately, there's a different rule for partnerships and proprietorships and shareholders of S corporations. But let's take a step back to where we started. If you live in New York, you pay tax on all of the flow-through income. Now, you may get a credit for taxes paid to other states on your flow-through income, but New York, at least in the first instance, taxes all of it. We're only talking about non-resident owners, mm-hmm. non-resident partners, non-resident S-corporation shareholders, or non-resident proprietors or proprietorships, those proprietorships that file on an individual 1040 form under Schedule C. Partnerships and proprietorships can use separate accounting to allocate income. So they can go item by item through their revenue and their expenses and determine what's a New York item and a non-New York item. And indeed, that is the preferred method according to the regulations, so the so-called direct accounting approach. The problem with that is it's almost impossible to figure out with clarity what is a New York item versus a non-New York item. For instance, if you have two offices, but all of the overhead expenses is carried on one of the offices, how do you attribute a particular item of overhead expense to either New York, if that's the location of where the expense item was incurred, versus Illinois, which is the location of your other office, where you've got income that overhead expense supports revenue generation in both locations? How do you figure that out? Very difficult to do that. So the regulations then revert to a three-factor formula for apportioning the income. They take all of the, shouldn't say all of the entity's income. There is still an overriding allocating rule for income from real property sales and personal property sales. That is commandment one. But once you get past commandment one, you get to commandment two, which is you take all of the income, you take the net amount of that income after you reduce it by expenses, and you apply a three-factor apportionment formula, which is an equally weighted property, payroll, and gross income factor. And you come up with a fraction that you apply to that income, and that is the New York source income from a partnership or a proprietorship. Interestingly, I think, from a planning standpoint, is that the gross income factor is based on the origin of the work. So if your only office is in Illinois, but you do all of your work for clients in New York, under New York's rule for partnerships and proprietorships, that's all Illinois source income.
Interesting. So origin is defined as place of office. Headquarters?
Yeah, place of office.
That seems so counterintuitive to everything that we discussed.
It's a very antiquated rule. I don't understand why, number one, New York uses a three-factor formula. Hardly anybody uses three-factor formulas anymore. It's certainly different than the rule that applies to S corporations and C corporations for apportioning income. It's an anachronism, and it should be changed.
You haven't put on your tinfoil hat yet, right? But isn't one of the reasons that it makes sense because historically, that's where most people worked, right? So businesses with a New York connection, if they have this rule, right, most of the sort of service providers working from a New York office, even if I don't live here, resulted in higher New York apportionments in those years. It seems to me that there might be a reckoning with respect to those rules in a remote working world, right?
Yeah, back in the day before you guys were born, most partnerships were professional service companies, right? Law firms, accounting firms, architecture firms. There were hardly any partnerships that did manufacturing, construction work. Those were all C corporations or S corporations. Using a partnership form to run like a big business or a big non-professional services activity is something that is new, like within the last 30 or 40 years. So that is why I think that they've kind of stuck, number one, had this sort of antiquated where the offices approach because they didn't want lawyers, getting admitted pro hac vice in a bunch of different states and doing work in a bunch of different states and not paying any tax in New York, even though, their main office was in New York. Think about where Ernst & Young's office was, well, Ernst & Winnie back then, where, you know, Arthur Andersen's offices were. Like, their big offices were in New York. All the big law firms, all their biggest offices were in New York. And that's why I think that that sort of anachronistic approach has hung on for so long, because it makes absolutely no sense, because when you compare it to the S corporation approach, it gives planners like us an opportunity to game the system. And there shouldn't be an opportunity to do that, but thank God there is. So let's talk about S corporations. S corporations uses a single factor receipts approach, and receipts are based on where the benefit of the service is received or where the destination of the product is. So it's based on where the market is. It's not based on where the work is done. It's not based on where your office is. It's where the benefit of the service or the product, it's where your customer is.
Right.
Or where your client's located.
And that seems much more contemporary. Like, to me, that seems like, oh, this S corporations have a modern sensibility to them based on those rules.
Right. It takes away taxes as a decision on where to put your business, right? Because it's all based on where your market is, not based on where your machines and your people are.
Right.
You know, where your human capital and your physical capital are located doesn't matter anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, again, makes a great deal of sense to me. But what happens is, you know, taxpayers get to choose. So if it's going to benefit you because your only office is in Florida, well, you're going to choose your partnership form. And if all of your customers are in Florida, but your only office is in New York, well, you're going to use the S corporation form and be able to, like I said, game the system that way. And you can even have a mix where you've got a partnership that has certain partners that are direct partners, and they get the partnership three-factor where your office is approach, and non-residents get to use an S corporation to hold their partnership interest. And by funneling the income through an S corporation, you get to use the single-factor market-based approach for apportioning your income. So it's a powerful tool that shouldn't be there.
Hmm. Well, but aren't we glad it is, as tax planners?
Sure.
Well, and to add a little bit more complexity to it, right? One of the things that I'm often talking to people who are changing their residence about is the source of the income going forward. And if I'm a partner in a partnership and I convert to S Corp, I'm going to get a different apportionment rule, but I may also now have the opportunity to pay myself a wage, right? And get some income allocated by workday fractions and not these other sort of business connections. And so it's, you know, I think it's important to understand all these rules up front, right? Because the decision that is appropriate for each particular person can be different depending on their circumstances.
Yes, there's absolutely no one-size-fits-all approach.
Well, plus there's interplay with the federal tax rules, of course.
Right. And Hudson Russ has federal tax lawyers that help us on those as well.
Yes, we do. And someday they'll be featured in a crossover episode. It'll be like, you know, Superman versus Batman.
Right. It'll be Chicago Fire and Chicago Police.
Chicago Med.
And, right.
Oh, well, I think that's a good place to bring this conversation to an end. And again, you know, we could go on for hours and hours, but we don't want to give all the secrets away, right?
Right.
We got to keep some information to ourselves. Thanks again, everyone, for listening to today's episode of State Tax Talks with Joe Tantillo. I want to once again thank my guests, Mr. Drew Wright, Mr. Chris Doyle. This was a wonderful conversation filled with both knowledge and laughs, which is, you know, kind of what we're going for.
Thank you, Joe.
Thanks, Joe.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of State Tax Talks. If you're interested in listening to more episodes, we're available on all platforms where podcasts can be found, including YouTube. If you enjoyed this episode of State Tax Talks with Joe Tantillo, please give us a 5-star review on your favorite podcast platform. And if you're in need of a tax professional, you can contact the tax attorneys at Hodgson Russ. Go to www.hodgsonruss.com for more information. And until next time, I'm Joe Tantillo, and this is State Tax Talks. Catch you later, tax fans.